I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I am talking to Dilek Hussein Zadegan, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Emory University. We're discussing her 2019 book, Kant's Non-Ideal Theory of Politics, from Northwestern University Press. Hussein Zadegan works on Kant and German idealism, feminist theory, the Frankfurt School, critical philosophy of race, and post-colonial thought, and has published several articles on these topics in the Kantian Review, the Journal for the History of Philosophy, and Feminist Philosophy Quarterly. So first of all, Dilek, let me say thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dilek, I love the book. I love Kant, so there's that to begin with. But your book on Kant's non-ideal theory of politics really does is the best book I've read in quite a while on his anthropology, his sometimes called the sort of impure character of his thinking. So so thank you for that. Let me ask you first about what motivated you to write the book.
Thanks. I think there's a lot of work on Kant's political philosophy. I think we're seeing a proliferation of work on Kant's political philosophy. But I was interested in how Kant's political philosophy related to his critical system more broadly. I wondered if Kant really cared about political philosophy enough to say, maybe Arendt says, you know, is there a fourth critique of political reason? I also wondered what the place of teleology could be in his political philosophy, more than just kind of a hermeneutic of hope. I wondered if it could be another way of thinking about the world. So looking at the scholarship on Kant's political philosophy, I didn't see a lot of people talking about teleology in a sustained way. And if they did, it's always kind of in a, oh, you know, having a teleological history or gives us a notion of progress or something like that. It was kind of in a tangential way. So I wondered, you know, Kant is a systematic philosopher. He must have a sort of systematic understanding of how everything fits together from Doctrine of Right to the Enlightenment essay. Like, how is this going to, how can I put it altogether? I must mention that I do have a background in critical philosophy of race and post-colonial thought, so I am familiar with the other side of the scholarship where people criticize Kant's political philosophy on certain grounds. So I thought, you know, how can I bring Kant's political philosophy together in a critical system? Teleology suggested itself to me as this guiding thread of some of his political writings. So I thought this book had to be written, you know, like how to think about politics, not only as a system of rights, but political philosophy more broadly, the way that political theorists would understand it.
Yeah, so maybe that's a way to get into this, is the concept of teleology. I mean, it's interesting because, as you say, teleology isn't really a popular concept either in some parts of the Kant scholarship or in critical theory, right? So for instance, we had Amy Allen out here at Rice a couple weeks ago, and she has recent work on, you know, the lingering problem of teleology and Habermas's thought, for instance. So maybe you just start there with talking about the problem, why some Kant scholars like Lisa Ellis see some problems with identifying teleology in Kant's thought, and why, you know, critical theory more broadly is worried about teleology, and then we can get into how you sort of resolve those issues in a few minutes.
Thank you. I love Amy Allen's book. It's great. So I think the problem with teleology in Kant is that it looks like it is a principle that he uses in order to then get to a theodicy or the idea of God sort of regulating world events. So it sounds like it's a problem for politics, because in politics, we don't want to say, you know, it's all up to God. We want to say, no, our actions bring about change, reform, revolution, etc. So teleology sounds like everything is overdetermined already. So and politics needs, you know, not that much determination. That's a problem. It sounds like if we are thinking about a teleological worldview or something, it sounds like we are suggesting that the cause-effect relationships have already taken place. This is kind of an old school metaphysics, right? There is nothing new that can appear. Everything is predetermined. So political philosophers are wary of that. And I think it's a little different with Amy Allen. Amy Allen's critique of teleology and progress, insofar as I think she wants to criticize in the name of progress how we then categorize different civilizations and different cultures as more or less advanced. And that to me is related insofar as we're saying, you know, culture is teleological, so there are better cultures or worse cultures. Civilization is teleological. There's an end of civilization and it has to be a liberal democratic society. So if we are determining it from the beginning, then of course when we go to a society looking at their institution, if they're not liberal or democratic, we're going to put them to the sort of bottom of the, or like earlier stages of that teleological progress or the spectrum. So I think Amy Allen criticizes the idea of teleology for that reason, for giving rise to this classification of civilizations or cultures in this way. And I think that's right. I mean, Elizabeth Ellis said, you know, we have to like just not read the parts where Kant is proposing a teleological worldview because it is sort of straitjacket of politics. It's kind of not allowing us to talk about human actions as meaningful. It is as if there's a hand of God in everything and everything is already predetermined. I agree with that. So I want to think of teleology not as this thick ontological structure of the world, but as a way of thinking, as Kant says in the Third Critique. So it's a way of looking at the world where you see a lot of contingency, things usually don't make sense, there's a lot of diversity, multiplicity of things, and you want to know how it all fits together. That's, to me, what teleology does for Kant, as he calls it. It's the lawfulness of the contingent. So we're looking at the world, looking at all these diverse things and trying to figure out how it all fits together. At the same time, for Kant, teleology is not a constitutive principle of the world. So it's not ontologically the case that everything has a purpose. It's that as human beings, we are meaning-making creatures. So this is something Rudy McCreal would enjoy, right? That we look at the world and we try to make meaning. So teleology is just that way of looking at the world and trying to make meaning under one idea or one whole, one concept or one principle. So I think that that's helpful to politics in the way that we can use teleology as this just way of looking at the world and making sense of it, sort of making a theoretical map of the world's current circumstances in order to be able to diagnose what's going on in our world. So that's very relevant to political theory. I would say it's not a straitjacket. It's actually kind of liberating for politics to be able to talk about real stuff with a certain picture at hand. That is, for Kant at least, a regulative principle. That is a regulative way of looking at the world that is subject to change.
Lots of good stuff there. One thing to say, I think a little bit later, I'll ask you about is to see if Kant can respond to something like an Amy Allen charge. Like, I wonder if you know your understanding of Kant's teleology, if it's if it's progress or if it can escape that kind of progressive. But let's hold off on that until we get your view on. So just to sort of clarify a little bit more on the notion of teleology and Kant, for those who don't know Kant that well or have haven't read him since graduate school or something, there's been a longstanding approach to Kant to see him as a kind of arch deontological thinker, a thinker of abstract legalism. And so the very notion of teleology may have appear kind of odd or strange. And so it strikes me there are sort of two developments in the Kant scholarship that have kind of overturned this, and maybe you can add to this or revise it, but one of them I think you might call it a sort of more comprehensive way of thinking about teleology and Kant, which is to think about the overall teleological character of the critical system as a whole, that is to think about the critiques, the three critiques, as forming a teleological system that follows from something like you know, when Kant talks about reason, he doesn't talk about reason as something like a passive faculty, but it's something that's active, that has interests, that has an end. And so there's a way in which the sort of Kant's moral philosophy, broadly understood, can be thought of as a kind of teleological system. And I'm thinking about people like, well, Richard Velkley many years ago, but also Paul Guyer has been pushing this line. But but your approach to teleology, I think, picks up on the, I think, what may be called a sort of second development in revising Kant, which is to pay attention to the fact that Kant is was very attentive to the empirical character of human beings. Like he thought a lot about human nature and had a lot of interesting things to say about it. So maybe you could say a little bit about, I think, what Robert Loudon calls the impure ethics of Kant, and how you see your work as fitting into that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So part of it is that I've seen Kant use this language of teleology, purposiveness, having purposes in his political writings. And I'm like, why is he talking about nature's purpose in the essay on perpetual peace? Like, what does it have to do with anything? We were just talking about a League of Nations and how to eventually get rid of all arms. Why now nature has to be purposive and teleological? So I kind of like puzzled. That was puzzling to me. But you're right that he talked about human nature and culture and geography all of his life, as is now well known, I guess. He lectured on anthropology and physical geography almost all of his career. There are people who said, oh, he did that, you know, to make money because those lectures were so popular. But I think he also wants to say, look, in order to apply these abstract legal moral ideas, we need to have a good sense of what human beings are actually like. And that's the Robert Loudon point, is that, okay, we have his ethics. It has a formal principle. It is pure. It's abstract. It is, you know, there's an a priori principle of the categorical imperative that gives us all the law that we need. But we also need to know how it applies to human beings, right? We need to know if we are susceptible to reason. We need to know if we're susceptible to moral law. We need to know how we get there if we are not. And Kant is clear we're not there yet, right? So he also lectured on pedagogy. So he thought a lot about that. And Robert Loudon made possible the kind of work that I'm doing alongside Holly Wilson, who thinks a lot about Kant's anthropology, and Alex Cohen recently has this book that talks about Kant on the human sciences, where, okay, so we know Kant is a formalist, we know Kant is interested in abstract principles, etc. But how can we take these and apply them to the human beings as they are here now? So, and he did develop, so Robert Loudon says, you know, Kant does have a second part of his ethics. It is the impure ethics, where he talks about anthropology, pedagogy, religion, geography, sort of the very real conditions of the human life, so that he has a sense of how we can then apply the categorical imperative. So what we need in order to be receptive to acting morally, or in order to make categorical imperative our major principle. So I was thinking this sort of an analogy between the way that Robert Loudon talks about ethics and the way that I was thinking about politics. I think you're right that Kant's political philosophy is considered to be some abstract legalism. A lot of people focus on either the doctrine of rights, which there's some social contract theory there, some liberalism, and then perpetual peace, you know, is very popular among anyone who wants to do contemporary political philosophy. So I was thinking that Kant is using the principle of rights as this ideal formal principle of politics, but he was also interested in working out how this principle of right can apply to human beings here and now. So he does provide a lot of reflections on the non-ideal circumstances in which we find ourselves, like, okay, are we in an enlightened age? No, we are in an age of enlightenment. It's still ongoing, right? We still need more freedom of speech, more freedom of thought. Are we living in a cosmopolitan world? No, that should be our first goal, to get there so that we have a constitution by which we all act as citizens, etc. So I found him using teleological language to talk about these kinds of concerns in the non-ideal material world. And I'm calling it the impure politics, or as I guess in the title of the book, the non-ideal theory of politics. That is the second part of his political philosophy. This is not to say, and I think Robert Loudon would agree with this too, this is not to say that, oh, now let's give up on the formal or the ideal part of his politics. Of course, Kant is still known for this a priori commitment to morality and justice. But I think it's important to sort of look into the second part of his ethics and politics to get a fuller picture.
Yeah, and so that, I think, leads into the ideal, non-ideal distinction that you make, which you draw from contemporary political philosophy. So mm-hmm. maybe you could just connect Kant, the pure and the impure, or the noumenal and the phenomenal, with the mm-hmm. with the ideal and the non-ideal. Mm-hmm. I mean, one question I have is, do those distinctions line up? Maybe a different way to ask the question is, what's the purpose of thinking about human nature, I guess, broadly understood in Kant? Is it a pragmatic purpose, that is, mm-hmm. or an instrumental purpose? That is, how can we can understand human beings a little bit better? Mm-hmm. In order to move us towards the ideal moral community that Kant wants to move us towards? Or is it more like a way to give us hope, to justify mm-hmm. hope, so we don't fall into despair, a kind of dispositional approach? And I think those are maybe somewhat different in both present and Kant. So maybe you could say a little bit about what the role you think of human nature, say, in the political theory project is, and then how it then connects up with the contemporary non-ideal ideal theory distinction.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I think they are both present in Kant. I think that, for instance, in that idea essay, Idea for a Universal History with a Cosmopolitan Intent, he does talk a lot about hope. Right. It would be better if we could hope that we are making progress, so that we don't think, oh, nothing I do matters and I don't need to do anything. I can be evil. I can be a bad citizen, all of these things. So I think the hope piece and the pragmatic piece are both present in Kant. I am, in my reading at least, emphasizing the pragmatic purpose of a theory of nature, theory of human nature for Kant. Not because I don't think the hope piece is not there, but I think that one of the ways in which I was thinking about the ideal theory, non-ideal theory distinction in political theory was that, the Rawlsian liberalism that is sort of mainstream in political philosophy generally lately tends to deal a lot in ideal theory, right? If we are going to the theory of justice, there is this idea of, okay, let's start from an original position where we don't know anything about human nature. We do know a little bit about human nature, but we don't know anybody's backgrounds and what would the principles of justice and fairness look like in that circumstance, ideally speaking. It's a thought experiment. That's one way to do political philosophy, but I think... once we reveal those principles of justice, fairness, etc., we then have a responsibility to see if they are actually achievable and if they are actually feasible. And we also need to know if they're not feasible, why are they not feasible? Did we have a bad sampling of the humans we're looking at, or is it actually just impossible for beings like us to act in these ways? So to me, it's more the pragmatic aspect of things that we need to, in order to do effective political theory, we need to be able to read the world correctly and diagnose the world correctly. That's where we need non-ideal theory, I think, to complement ideal theory. One of the things that as always, like a shorthand for me to think about the importance of non-ideal theory or if what I'm now calling the knowledge of the world or something is Kant's lectures on anthropology and physical geography. When he lectures on these, he starts always by saying, you know, young men, you know, we're going to need to be good cosmopolitan citizens. And a good cosmopolitan citizen means someone who knows the world. And I think that's part of what non-ideal theory tries to do, is tries to read the world, right? Know the world, so that the political ideals that we develop are relevant and applicable and feasible here and now, as opposed to sort of giving us this aspirational, or only giving us the aspirational ideals. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
What do you think about ideal theory, non-ideal theory stuff as a political scientist?
Well, I'm not sure what to make particularly of that distinction. I mean, I guess to put it in a broader context, I mean, it strikes me that one of the things that Kant is trying to do in the broad sweep of modern political thought is to, I mean, Kant is clearly working within a tradition of modern political thought, say, that was inaugurated by Machiavelli, in which there's a revision in the conception of human nature to be somewhat, you know, sort of evil or debased, you know, somewhat problematic view of human nature, such that it's very difficult to achieve the high ideals that that the ancients were hoping for. And Kant, clearly dissatisfied with that with that approach, that is sort of giving up on the high moral ideals that that was promised by the ancients and the religious aspirations, but yet respectful of the, I think, what's revealed about anthropology by the Machiavellian tradition. So he's trying to figure out, I mean, in other words, I think he's trying to, as you say, figure out a way to bring the, you know, the high ideals that he hopes for back down to earth, specifically on the basis of the, you know, to show that the Machiavellians, even on their basis, that he can achieve these ideals. Mm-hmm. That even the devils, you know, the famous perpetual peace idea, that the devils can have this state too. So yeah, I guess that's the kind of context that I think of putting Kant into, and I think that's congenial with the contemporary approach.
So I use sort of Charles Mills's distinction between ideal theory and non-ideal theory, and the way I divide then Kant's political philosophy into these two parts will have to do with, if Kant is talking about an idealized ontology or an idealized notion of agents, and I find him doing that a lot in the most parts of the doctrine of right, where, you know, he's interested in not the matter of our interactions, but the form of our interactions. He say we are all innately free, which, and then that he's going to look at the human beings as noumenal beings, etc. So this to me is ideal theory, right? An idealized notion of human beings. But in certain parts of the doctrine of right and the other things that I read, the idea essay, the perpetual peace essay, parts of the third critique, what's enlightenment, he then has a more earthbound sort of back, as you said, you know, earthbound picture of human beings, that we are prone to errors, or we are under the influence of emotions still, we kind of misunderstand each other, etc. So that's where I sort of see him dealing in non-ideal theories. Like, okay, we have the a priori principles, principle of categorical imperative and Recht, which I don't really want to get into how they're related at all. But let's say we have the principle of Recht, right? That's going to give us a formal idea of what our relationships of justice ought to look like. And that's a good thing to work out. But I think without the other side, the non-ideal side or the impure side, it kind of becomes empty. Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm like, oh, it's a beautiful principle. It can be given a deduction and it can be given, you know, but I don't know if that principle applies to me. There's a good epigraph in Robert Loudon's book, which I like. I think it's from, I want to say it's from Dewey. It's not someone I usually quote, but something like the wheel needs impurities as well as the pure shape of circle in order to move. So you need the purities and the impurities in order to move. And that's what I'm thinking of Kant's non-ideal theory. It's the impurities in our nature, but he's still trying to think of it as a whole, as making sense. Like, how do we make sense of these things that do not really neatly fit into our, you know, abstractions or idealized notions of human beings? We need that in order to make the wheels turn, if that makes sense.
Right, right. And that, that's the, I think, the key contribution of your book is that, so it's not just that we need to attend to the impure, non-ideal, empirical character of human beings, but that Kant advocates doing so in a teleological fashion. Mm-hmm, so why don't we get into that, what that actually means? You started to introduce that at the beginning of our conversation, and you do it a good deal more in the first part of your book. The book has three parts. And the first part is on the notion of teleology or purposiveness in Kant. And you trace that notion through the first critique, the What is Orientation and Thinking essay, and then the Critique of Judgment. So maybe I could just say a little bit more about this notion about the lawfulness of the contingent. Do I have that right? Lawfulness of the contingent. That's the the main, I guess, the character and nature of teleological judgment in Kant.
Yeah, thank you. So without getting super technical, I guess, let me see if I can sort of make sense of how I think about teleology as a way of thinking about the world. So, you know, so it comes from looking at organisms, right? In the third critique, Kant thinks that organisms have a purpose, that are organized around that purpose, and every part of the organism makes sense in relation to the whole. And then if we take this way of thinking to other objects, such as the state, which I will get into later, but history, let's say in the first part I talk about history, does history as a whole make sense? Can we say that it has a purpose around which it is organized, that it is following some kind of plan, right? So that's the question of the idea for a universal history essay. And there are so many readings of this essay. It's so important to Kant's political philosophy that everyone kind of treats this essay as, oh, this is the first robust treatment that Kant gives to the notion of cosmopolitanism. And we have to claim that we can achieve cosmopolitanism. Here is why, if we think of history in this way. I think that that's right, but one other aspect, that the way that I enter into this text is through teleology, is to say, look, Kant is asking a question about history. Why is he asking a question about history? This is supposed to be a political essay on cosmopolitanism. So number one, then it means he thinks that a certain picture of history will be relevant to cosmopolitanism. So, and then the second question is, how is he constructing this picture of history? And I say he's using teleology as a way of thinking holistically about history, meaningfully about history. So then he constructs this, history as a whole is making progress, even though we don't see it in this, the singular actions of human beings. We have to assume, on a larger scale, it makes sense, and it's working towards improvement of our civil constitution. Start with the Greeks. There's an episode of The Barbarians, but then we have the Renaissance, and then we have the Enlightenment Age. Now, we can see that our civil constitution is making progress for the sake of the human beings and for better human relations overall. So that's the picture of history that he constructs by positing, hypothetically, history as a whole makes sense. History as a whole has a purpose, right? So in the third critique, he calls teleology the lawfulness of the contingent. So it is helpful to think about this contingent elements of history as lawful, not because we know, right? It's not a dogmatic claim. We don't know if history actually has a purpose. We don't know if it's actually going to bring us to cosmopolitanism. But it helps us to think in these terms. You know, he calls it the lawfulness of the contingent. Yes, lots of historical events are contingent, but we can always tell a story about them that gives them meaning. So in the sense of that, I use teleology not in this thick, you know, everything has a meaning way, but it is a way of organizing historical events around a story. So, and I see him doing that, telling us a certain kind of story that is relevant for his cosmopolitan ideals. And the story is told by means of teleology. So if teleology is that. So, you know, things happen. I think I gave this example in the book. Franz Ferdinand, you know, was assassinated. Okay, so that's a historical fact. It's contingent. But in this grand scheme of things, we tell the story of this assassination as the beginning of the First World War, right? When this event was happening, nobody thought, okay, I'm going to start the First World War. I'm going to assassinate this guy. But now when we reflect on it as a whole, we see that there's this story we tell about the First World War. So that is what I see teleology doing. It's helping us tell a story that has an overarching meaning, which, again, it has to be tentative, but in Kant's case, it helps us to sort of conceptualize cosmopolitanism as a feasible goal.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's super interesting the way you develop that from the third critique, because, so the traditional understanding of teleology, say, you know, a rough and ready Aristotelian version, which Kant maybe or maybe not uses in the 1780s, but let's set that aside. Along the model of the organic teleology, which is a species is constructed to have a particular purpose on Earth, and it is born and has an end or telos that it grows toward. Human beings are kind of strange. Kant says in the Idea essay in the first couple propositions that individuals don't particularly achieve their telos, but only the species does, and the species achieves its telos only through the whole of its history. And so that you might say is a sort of traditional understanding of teleology, and I think why it gets such a bad name, I think, from Kant scholars and others is clear. But then in the third critique, and as you point out, even in the first critique, there's some glimmers here that Kant argues that thinks that you can't justify or ground those teleological judgments as constitutive of the world as it is. We can't see teleology at work, and so it runs up against certain kinds of epistemological restrictions that Kant outlines in the first critique. And so it becomes a sort of necessary regulative judgment. And so that's the key distinction between the constitutive and the regulative judgment. And so do I have this right? I mean, so that's how, you know, it's the regulative character of teleology, I think, that's the basis for how you think about this sort of narrative approach. Maybe you could just connect those two, because Kant doesn't use the language of sort of narrativity. It kind of sounds almost, as I was reading, it kind of almost sounds like Gadamer, you know, a kind of hermeneutic approach almost, that you see proto-hermeneutic. So maybe you could sort of connect Kant's language up with the sort of narrative or hermeneutic and,
Yeah, great. Thank you. So I think you're right that I am, somebody told me this and I was like, oh, well, thank you. I think I'm re-enchanting the notion of teleology in Kant, in the sense that, of course, I'm interested in what teleology is and what it means, but I think I'm more interested in it, or what I'm more sort of, I'm motivating what teleology does for Kant. So what does teleology point out, systematically speaking, the use of teleology, or what it does, it gives us a narrative, etc. One of the sort of, Gadamer is an interesting thing to bring up. I've never read Gadamer, I'm happy to admit. But Rudy McCreel would enjoy this line of thinking, I think, the thinking of the narrative. And I think I might be influenced by his way of thinking about teleology and the third critique on these issues. One of the ways to connect what I'm talking about, the narrative of history that Kant gives in the Idea essay, to what he's talking about, he actually does use the term roman, right? That he says, this sounds absurd. I'm telling a story like, you know, here's how the human beings progresses over time, not the species, not the individuals, but the species, etc. It sounds strange. It sounds as if I'm writing some kind of a novel, right? That with a beginning, with a middle, and an end. So he says, of course, that's not what I'm trying to do. I want to talk about real life, and this is how it's happening. But we need a sort of a Bildungsroman, right? We need a kind of a developmental novel of humanity to support our idea of where we want to go from here. So he is, I think, giving us a story. So the regulative, as you said, the regulative use of teleology, what it does is to give us a tentative picture of the world. And it is sort of open to reinterpretation, open to contestation in a lot of ways. So I guess I'm taking it from Rudy McCreel, one might say. But I do find language in Kant as well to say, we need a story here. We need to tell ourselves a story to on the one hand, you know, those two related things we talked about earlier, to keep up the faith, keep up the hope. But also we need this story in order to make cosmopolitanism possible or like achievable or feasible for us.
Yeah, so then it serves two functions. I mean, it serves two functions in a way to respond to the two critics that we brought up earlier. I mean, on the one hand, against the kind of Lisa Ellis worry about the determinism that's implicit in teleology. It's not deterministic, it's just regulative. Mm-hmm. And against the kind of critical theory worry, maybe you could say a little bit about this, because this is one of the really cool things about it, in some ways we might say that Kant had a Eurocentrism, right? Often said. Mm-hmm. And his way of thinking about human history was emphatically sort of Eurocentric in a certain way. Mm-hmm. However, if we develop this kind of conception of teleology that's open and revisable, mm-hmm. Then we can revise Kant's teleology, and he would have welcomed that, right?
Yes, in general, yes. So that's, I think, the reason why I want to mobilize teleology is exactly that, is that it keeps Kant's political philosophy a bit more dynamic. It can sort of talk about the Eurocentrism. But let me talk a little bit about how I think of Kant's Eurocentrism. We might be on a slightly different page. One of the ways in which, when he talks about universal history in the idea essay, he gives a very explicitly European history, right? So he thinks, so that's one sort of mild definition of Eurocentrism, is to think that Europe is the center of the world, or that European values or European ideas are universal or universalizable. So I think, in a way, if teleology is a way of thinking about the world holistically, then Kant failed to think about it as holistically as he could have, right? So like his sample or his model is smaller than it should have been. So I think we would agree in the end, like, we can expand this notion of universal to include more than Europe, and Kant would be okay with it. But I'm also worried about saying that now we can rescue all of Kant's, those ideals of cosmopolitanism or culture or civilization or something like that and make it truly universal. So I see that move as too quick and too simplistic. One of the ways I'm thinking about this is, look, we have to say Kant didn't think of the rest of the world when he said world history and universal history or culture. He did not have that in mind. But it's not the fault of this way of thinking. He didn't think big enough in a way, right? So he kind of used teleology too locally, too provincially, in a sense. He should have considered more holistically the world, right? And then maybe he could have come up with a notion of what lots of postcolonial, decolonial thinkers are calling pluriversality, right? It's a plural universality. So it's a pluriversality. There's multiple universes or multiple values, ideals. So that's where I am. I think we're agreeing, but I don't want to let him off the hooks too easy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that does make sense. I mean, we're talking about in the second part, maybe we can turn to that, but you, the specific example of culture in Kant is interesting. Maybe just right before we get there, the second part you turn to Kant's political theory proper from his view of teleology and history. And one of the surprising things you do in this part is that you point out the places where Kant speaks of the state as an organism, as mm-hmm. a kind of organic, mm-hmm. As having an organic character. And this is very, very redolent of Hegel, of course. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can say a little bit about in what way is the state organic for Kant? Why did he think of the state as organic? Mm-hmm. And how is his view of the state then different from Hegel's organic view?
Yeah, thank you. So I guess I don't think I say Kant's state is organic, and he does think of the state as an organism, and I do want to emphasize as an analogy, so it's like an organism, right? So, but its unity should be like an organic unity, but it is not actually an organism. So I think we would agree that he does think state is an artificial construction. It's not a natural construction. It's not a biological thing. So we're not political animals for Kant, right? So similarly, so two things. One, again, I'm interested in what this language of teleology, language of organism, is doing for Kant's political philosophy. It seems to be giving him a way of talking about state as an organism. And he says this is an important analogy. We shouldn't conflate, a state and an organism, of course, but this is an important analogy to see what an ideal state should look like. In an ideal state, each branch of the government should be like a limb, should be like a part of the whole body, right? Each citizen's purpose should be aligned with and is subsumable under the purpose of the whole state. I take these as interpretive clues, this organic vocabulary as interpretive clues. Once again, if teleology is a way of thinking about the world, organisms is where the teleology comes from for Kant. So what is this language of organism doing for Kant is that it is allowing him to say, look, ideally, states should function like an organism. Where everything is connected and there's a whole and there are parts, etc. I find that in the third critique, when he talks about the American Revolution and how he thinks of the new the colonies as sort of constituting an organic, almost organic assembly, organic institution. In the Enlightenment essay, he talks about the public use of reason as a cosmopolitan whole, in which everybody is doing their part in order to contribute to the purpose of the humankind. So it's kind of like an organism. Everyone is like, if everyone is allowed the public use of reason to be free, then the freedom of the whole will be an achievable goal. In the Doctrine of Right, he talks about metamorphosis versus paleogenesis as revolution. So I kind of, again, I'm not looking at, so there's a lot of people who work on these pieces, like Susan Schell talks about the use of organism in Kant's ethics and politics. I'm interested in that, but I'm asking sort of a systematic question, like what is Kant trying to do with this use of organisms? And again, if teleology is regulative, if this language of state as organism and cosmopolitanism as a big organic whole of the universe, what is he trying to get at here? That he's telling us, look, human beings are not just machines, right? They're more than machines. So should the states. So should the states be more than machines. So that's one way to think about it. The other way to think about it is, look, in the Doctrine of Rights, we are talking about the formal relations of or formal interactions between human beings, or the institutions that we need in order to have justice and rights. But again, these human beings are not just noumenal. They're not these super sensible beings. They are flesh and bone. They are earthbound creatures. So it's kind of, I take it as like he's kind of hinting at this earthbound notion of human beings here, and that how state, while of course it's not an organic whole, it functions best if it is like an organism where everyone works in harmony towards one purpose.
Yeah, so let me follow up on that, just because I wonder about the sort of critical response to that. Mm-hmm. And because I think this maybe touches on the broader maybe issues with teleology and Kant, because mm-hmm. I think one of the worries about thinking of the state like an organism and that we should all think of ourselves as part of a whole is, mm-hmm. you know, where's the space for a kind of critical purchase on the state, mm-hmm. or thinking of oneself as outside of the state or as part of two mm-hmm. states rather than just one mm-hmm. state? I take it that you know, there would be some worries from a critical theory perspective about mm-hmm. the kind of ideological character mm-hmm. of a kind of organic understanding of the state, that it sort of inserts individuals within a whole that mm-hmm. they can't think outside of.
Yeah, no, totally. And you did ask, I don't think I answered the question of how is it different than Hegel's. And I take it that, you know, this critique would apply to Hegel more clearly, I guess, that all, if we are all part of a whole, like, where's my individuality, or right. like, what happens to me when I don't fulfill that purpose? Am I rejected? Am I outside? So because teleology is a way of thinking for Kant, I think it provides a certain kind of perspective, but because it's not constitutive, we can think of the state in different ways. So for Hegel, I think what it is what it ought to be in terms of this organic whole. So Hegel is not saying this is just one way of thinking about the state. With Kant, if the state as organism is as actually a metaphor or an analogy, which I don't know the difference necessarily in this context, then he's going to say, I'm using this vocabulary here to point out some character of human beings and states together. But that's not the end of it. That's not end all be all of the state. It is just the picture I'm providing that might be useful as we think about the state. But I don't think that it is, again, it's important to say it's not the case that Kant, for Kant, state is organic. It is like an organism. And when Kant gives us this vocabulary, we are supposed to sort of have a way of thinking about the state holistically as one functioning whole. It's not that there's nothing outside it, because he will have to maintain, right, in the Enlightenment essay, for instance, we have the private use of reason where we do whatever everyone else says, but we have to, in a real cosmopolitan whole, what is most important is the public use of reason. We develop that, etc. So I again think, I guess, these two as like perspectives he's providing us with, and this is a useful, again, pragmatically useful perspective on state as a giant organism, because it reminds us that, oh yeah, we're not machines. Oh yeah, we're not just noumena, right? That we are somewhere in between.
Yeah, and that's certainly helpful and illuminating in Kant. I mean, one of the things this reminds me of is critiques of Habermas that are mm-hmm. sometimes given by the agonistic democracy folks, mm-hmm. you know, so Habermas is sometimes accused of, you know, the problem with the deliberative democracy in Habermas is it aims towards consensus, mm-hmm. right? It's a sort of that's the ultimate telos, I guess, of his, mm-hmm. his political philosophy. And so this is a sort of objectionable to the agonistic folks who see in that as you know, much too constraining. And so I guess that's the one of my worries here about mm-hmm. you know, conceit. I mean, I guess maybe you have to put the question more broadly. I mean, in thinking about Kant and teleology, are we locked into thinking teleologically about politics for him, or can we mm-hmm. think, is it possible? I mean, or is that just one option for us that we can mm-hmm. think, you know, mm-hmm. contingently or outside of teleology?
So I think we are locked in, but I think being locked in to teleology is not a bad thing. So the way I am thinking about, like, if Kant gives us if teleology is actually bridging, you know, the first critique and the second critique together, what is the notion of human beings in the first critique? It is, we are discursive beings. We are sensibility as well as understanding. We are these dualistic creatures, and that's how cognition occurs. Cognition cannot be just conceptual. It cannot be just intuitions. It has to be a combination of the two. Then we have a problem when it comes to morality, is that we want to say sensibility gets in the way of morality. We want to say moral reason or practical reason has to be pure. It has to sort of divorce itself from all sensibility, intuitions, inclinations, feelings, etc. Teleology is supposed to bridge these two ways of thinking about human being and the world, in the sense that, look, we are both of these things at the same time. We are flesh and blood, so that means we are affected by our environment and externally, and we also have feelings and sensibility internally. But we, at the same time, we are free in the sense that we are the only kinds of organisms that can give law to itself. So it's teleology, I think, is the appropriate way to think about politics, at least in Kant, because otherwise we either have sort of a mechanistic view of human beings, we are all rational. Well, I guess that's not the way to think about mechanism, but we are all machines, causally determined, locked into, you know, one way of thinking about the world, or we are just noumena and we are close to angels and we can make decisions without taking into account our sensibility or feelings. So I think teleology bridges these two ways of thinking about the world and the human being. And so we are locked into thinking teleologically in politics. But I think, again, so then the next step will be teleology for Kant is a hermeneutic. It's a way of thinking about the world that is regulative, not constitutive. So it is sort of more dynamic than we think it is. So we're locked into it, but dynamically.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, one way, I guess, maybe just to put it in an everyday way, is that, mm-hmm. you know, any approach to politics involves some kind of, I don't know, vision of a mm-hmm. better political world. And that vision has an ideal character to it, that it, you know, it involves a certain ideal conception of justice, but it's also mm-hmm. attractive in a certain way. It has an aesthetic character mm-hmm. that appeals to our sensibility. Mm-hmm. And that vision is teleological in nature. I mean, in a way, that's unavoidable to think teleologically in politics. So mm-hmm. so that's something I can get beyond.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me ask you about culture in Kant. This is something I've been interested in for a while, and mm-hmm. and you give a very good reading of a couple sections of the appendix to the Critique mm-hmm. of Teleological Judgment, where mm-hmm. Kant has a very, you know, mature discussion about culture. And Kant thinks of culture as the, you know, the end, the telos of our natural development. It's the community in which we fully develop what he calls skill, mm-hmm. our human ability to achieve our natural ends. And maybe I could say a little bit about, I mean, maybe this is a good place to sort of pause and think about this Eurocentric character of mm-hmm. Kant and mm-hmm. and where you see that creeping in here in his mm-hmm. view of culture.
Yeah, thanks. So I think this has been kind of established, that culture for Kant is the meeting point of nature and freedom, in a way, just to be sort of broad about it. And what I mean by this is that, yeah, as you said, culture is the culmination of our natural development. And once we develop the right kind of culture, we'll continue developing as moral agents this time, right, towards freedom. So culture is this transitional stage from being fully embedded in nature and being only ruled by inclinations, etc. Once we achieve the stage of culture and civilization, we're in the midpoint between that and freedom, where we will be moral agents and giving rational human beings. So that sounds good abstractly, right? So you can say, okay, every civilization has to go through this, maybe get away from nature, build some kind of a culture where there's a constitution or there's a way of doing things. And then from there, they develop even more toward being their own lawgivers or sovereigns and subjects, etc. So that sounds right in the abstract, but because this is non-ideal theory, so because it's not just talking in the abstract, Kant tells us in the third critique things like the lifestyle, the cultural lifestyle that is concerned only with happiness, the lifestyle that is concerned with pastoral existence, or something that just enjoyment or idleness, etc. Those lifestyles are not considered culture in the full sense that Kant wants to say, in the sense of transitioning from nature to freedom. This is something Günter Zöller recently talked about, that he does have a hierarchy of what cultural activity works as worthy of the name of culture or worthy of this transitional, worthy of being called this transitional picture. So again, we are used to thinking about this, you know, from the groundwork even, where we say, okay, of course, happiness is not an end goal of morality or rationality, because if it were, it would just be achieved by instinct. We need to think in our end goals in a different way. It can't be just this, etc. Okay, so that makes sense in ideal theory. In non-ideal theory, when he starts saying things like, you know, the South Sea Islanders are just letting their talents, you know, lay dormant, and they are just indulging in enjoyment and nothing more. When he says things like the Tahiti's inhabitants, if they are not poked by other people, Europeans, right, they will just have a an existence like sheep. So when he says these kinds of things, these are not value neutral judgments. He is telling us, look, the culture of these people who are not European, some cases indigenous, some cases islanders, are not really capable of being that transition point from nature to freedom. So not everyone will make this cut. Not everyone will be given this option to be a civilization first and then develop as moral agents. So that's where I'm seeing him. So like in the abstract, it makes sense. We transition from nature to culture to freedom. But when we look at how he is defining culture as development of skill versus, you know, letting your talents rust or just enjoying life, not developing passivity, etc. We're seeing that he's prioritizing a certain kind of culture, and that notion of culture is not value neutral. It's specifically European.
Yeah, so I guess maybe this is the place where the Amy Allen kind of worry mm-hmm. would come back in. I mean, I guess one way to state it is this strikes me as sort of an unavoidable result of teleological thinking. Maybe you can say why it's not. I mean, if you have a teleological way of thinking and you have some kind of imagined end goal, then there are going to be stages along the way, and there are going to be some that are, sometimes the phrase is, you know, behind the times, or we're on the right side of history. I mean, you know, we've used this in contemporary politics, which means that you know, some people are backwards. That is backwards in understanding it, you know, in this teleological fashion, and some people are forward thinking. So, you know, and that runs into that worry about progress that would be built into any kind of teleological thinking, and so I guess that's what how can teleology not be value neutral?
So I would go back to what I said earlier about Kant's version of this picture. So I think one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, but I do more of one than the other. So I try to do two things. One, and I do more of this to show Kant's model. Kant's model is this teleological model. He thinks holistically. There's an end goal, which is freedom. And then we go from nature to culture to cosmopolitanism to peace. So that seems to be his model. What I want to say, and this is not necessarily Kant, so I don't know, that's why I don't know if Kant would be okay with this or would welcome this. What I want to sort of get at the end, and I don't do much of this in the book, but that's kind of in the conclusion, I try to gesture towards it. What if there were more than one end goal? What if each civilization, each group of people were able to define the ends for themselves? What if, you know, there was a multiplicity of teleological pictures and Kant is only giving us the one way to think about it, which is the European way, which is provincial. But what if there were other ways of thinking about this transition? So I can see how at that time maybe we're losing the term teleology a little bit, and it just becomes more just some story or some way of thinking about the world, etc. But I think that's how I'm trying to think about teleology, not as a thick ontological principle, but as a way of thinking. So if there were other ways of thinking about culture that the end goal is sustainability as opposed to progress, that would be welcome in my picture, but I don't know that Kant would welcome it.
So then your worry would be about ideal theory then, right? Mm-hmm, that Kant only gives us one picture of the ideal and there can be a multiplicity of different ways. Or is the worry that Kant only gives us one road, like one path towards the ideal, and there are a multiplicity of different paths towards the ideal?
Let's see. So I guess it depends how we are thinking about the relationship between ideal and non-ideal theory, right? The way I am thinking about it, I want to be respectful of the Kantian way of thinking about it, where ideal will have to be normatively stronger than the non-ideal, etc. But I think I also want to say something like, the way that he is thinking about the ideals of cosmopolitanism has been inflected by how he is thinking about the non-ideal aspects of it, like culture, human nature, history, etc. So in his picture, sure, the ideal of peace sounds good and we should all sort of go towards it. But on the way there, he puts other benchmarks that seem very specific and sort of unique to the European way of thinking and doing, thinking about things and doing things. So that would be one way, but I do want to say that at the end, that is kind of affecting how, if this is the way we're going to achieve the ideals, right, then I may also be suspicious of that ideal. Like if you're telling me, this is the only way to peace, I might be suspicious. So that would be, you know, like, and if you're not doing this cosmopolitanism thing, or if you're not a liberal democracy, then you're behind the times. You're not doing it right. Or then I become suspicious. So I wanna have different non-ideal theories working toward the same ideal theory, perhaps. But in the end, what that ideal means might be different. So if the ideal is cosmopolitanism, there could be many versions of it, and there is right now, right? But I do not know if there are many versions of it that are coming from very different non-ideal theory undergirding them.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, so Kant places a lot of emphasis on commerce, mm-hmm, right, as a vehicle for peace. Mm-hmm. And one might question that but Kant seems to think of it as sort of inevitable. Mm-hmm. I also think about, you know, sort of his broader conception of human nature and some of the sort of fundamental empirical features of his thought. I mean, if you think about human beings as unsociable, being characterized by unsociable sociability, then you're going to, that's going to lead you on a certain path, but mm-hmm. Other cultures may think of human beings in different sort of ways. So, mm-hmm. so that's, yeah, I mean, that's point well taken. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, the question would be, and that's the question I think that you're asking, that you've posed to me, which is would Kant welcome that or not? that's a tough one. Maybe we'll leave that aside. I mean, this gets into the third part of your book, which is on perpetual peace. Mm-hmm. And you have a particularly interesting reading of the right to hospitality, which you see as you say, pragmatic, realistic, and a concrete solution rather than mm-hmm. a sort of a priori mm-hmm. approach. Maybe you could take us through, I mean, before we get to the hospitality in particular, we can talk a little bit about Perpetual Peace. It's such a well-known essay, mm-hmm. and you very well trace the notion of teleology through all the main parts of the work. So maybe just, mm-hmm. you know, pick a few parts mm-hmm. of that work and say a little bit about how your thesis sort of is advanced by the reading of this essay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, so in a way, I think Perpetual Peace and Doctrine of Right are largely part of Kant's ideal theory. He does talk about principle of right, and then he sort of gives us precepts of right, national, international, global, based on that. But I think that I was always struck by, so two things. One, the major part of the Perpetual Peace that uses teleology is the supplement, right? When he talks about nature guarantees peace. So you might want to say, oh, okay, cool, then let's just go home, you know, like, so you don't need to do anything. What was all this, you know, precept of peace about? If nature guarantees it, we don't have to do anything. So I've always been puzzled by what is going on here. So that's, I can talk about that in a little bit. But earlier on, even in the other parts of the Perpetual Peace, I do see him thinking teleologically in a very broad sense, not in a super technical sense, and there's an end goal of all this, but when he says, you know, the constitution of each state shall be republican, and I can give two kinds of proof for this claim. One, republicanism is the only kind of constitution in which agents are also the lawgivers and the subjects are also the sovereign in a way, right? No one can give a law that they themselves wouldn't subject themselves to. So that's kind of a priori ideal theory way of justifying the idea that each state will be republican. But then he says, in addition, the republican constitution is the most suitable for peace. So that's kind of a very basic means and thinking, right? Okay, if I am thinking about peace, I want to have a kind of a constitution in place that will facilitate that or that will kind of make wars unlikely or difficult or time-consuming or costly or something. And then he says, if there is a Republican constitution, that means that the decision to go to war, etc., will have to be decided based on the good of the whole. And of course, wars are costly. They cost money as well as other resources and human beings. So people will be reluctant to go to war. That means that we will have fewer and fewer wars and we'll be on our way to peace. So that's one way in which sort of I see a general means and thinking, even in the Perpetual Peace essay when he is describing these three ways of getting to peace. Each, you know, each state will be Republican, there should be a League of Nations, and the right to hospitality. So
can I just ask you about the Republican, just the Republican point, which I found interesting. So do you, just a sort of clarifying point, I think, I mean, do you see it as, you know, his commitment to republicanism as instrumental only, or is there, you know, so for instance, like if we found out that monarchy was better at ultimately mm-hmm. producing peace, he would be mm-hmm. a monarchist.
Oh yeah. I don't think so. I think,
Okay.
So I think it's giving us two perspectives. If I am right, right, okay, that we can take two perspectives on this one claim that is like every state shall be Republican, one, it does have an a priori origin, which is that it arises from the pure source of the concept of right, because it establishes principles of freedom, equality, and interdependence, right? So, yeah, no, that's republicanism. I don't think he will change that. But then it's also, furthermore, right, practically speaking or pragmatically speaking, it is conducive to minimizing the risk of war. So it's both, in a way. So I don't think that he would change his mind well, I guess he likes constitutional monarchy, but it's, I don't right. think he will change his mind about.
That's the step on the yeah. way to the truth. So the same goes then for the right to hospitality. Maybe say a little bit about that.
Yes, yes. So hospitality, he will say, I think it's really interesting that everyone thinks hospitality is something that comes out of the categorical imperative or something like that, but it's not the case, at least in the perpetual peace essay. So he's going to say, okay, so what is happening? The world is a globe. That means it's a finite surface, and eventually we'll have to come into contact with each other. That's just a fact. What's the best way to arrange our relationships, sort of bumping into each other, like individuals bumping into each other, would be to be nice to each other, be hospitable to each other. And the second aspect of this justification will be more teleological, because he's going to say, if this is the world in which we live, that is, we have to come into contact with one another one way or another, right? Then, sort of commerce in this case means both commerce, like trade, but also interaction. But I do make more with the trade part of it later. Then we have to institute a right of hospitality such that commerce can continue uninterrupted. So that's a minimalistic solution, but it comes from him reading the world pretty closely, right? So that's where we find him lamenting colonial interventions and colonial trade and people taking advantage of other cultures who don't have a contract theory or something like that. So that's where we get his critique of colonialism. At the same time, he's not saying stop with all that. He says, okay, how can we have commerce without colonialism? How can we have commerce given the state of the world where colonial commerce caused a lot of suffering and death and is taking us further away from perpetual peace? So hospitality in our interactions of commerce would be a pragmatic, realistic, and concrete way to be peaceful or to be peaceable with each other. So it's a minimal condition. So hospitality, you know, as you know, it's very limited in Kant. It's not the right to stay or hang out, or it's not even right to seek asylum or anything like that. But it is if the trader comes to you to sell goods, and if their intentions aren't to colonize you, you should be hospitable to them. That's what he's saying.
Right. I guess other ways that I tend to think about, I'll just run this past you, about cosmopolitan right, is that it also in a way sort of follows from his strong commitment to national sovereignty. That is that, I'm interested to back up. I mean, one thing is, you may think that it should follow from Kant's view of cosmopolitan right, that we mm-hmm. should have a world state, because that's what he says, you know, the only way really to preserve the external freedom of individuals from one another is to have a coercive authority. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't want to go all the way to a world state, I guess for various reasons we can talk about. But I think one of them at least is that that this worry that he has about the infringement on sovereignty, especially of the colonized countries, mm-hmm. And that this is a way, hospitality is a way to both, it has sort of balance the commitment to respecting rights of non-nationals with the sovereignty of the nation. Now maybe that sort of balancing act, you would characterize as sort of pragmatic overall. I guess I have a tough time thinking about what an alternative would be.
So I guess I was thinking more in terms of how Ben Habib thinks about hospitality as a human right, right? So she wants to extend it to the right of refugees and asylum seekers, which is super interesting, and it's been taken up in this way, even in the recent Syrian refugee crisis. We heard Angela Merkel use the term hospitality, mercy in this context of opening the borders, etc. So I don't think that's what Kant has in mind at all. So it's a noble goal to say, we should be hospitable to people who need our help, etc. So that's the way that I don't think that's what Kant has in mind. So that might be something that Ben Habib has in mind, but that's not what Kant had in mind. I think we would agree the hospitality is a rather it's like a yeah. I like what you said, the balancing act of some kind, right? That it's not really robust. It's not like, yes, let's have a world state that will tell us exactly how we should interact, or let's just be nice to everyone who comes to our doors or something. It's very circumscribed. It's very much about sort of only the right to visit for a limited amount of time for the sake of possible commerce. So it is this balancing act, but I think we might disagree on the sort of two-sidedness of hospitality. I do not see anywhere in the text, in Kant's text, or like I don't think Kant is thinking about it as a two-sided, for the reason that he limits it to a right of possible commerce. So who is interested in commerce at that time, or like the specific context he's talking about is India and England and the Sugar Islands and Britain, So he's kind of it's a one-way street, right? That he's telling the people who are interested in possible commerce to behave. So it's not a sure, yeah, and respect their national sovereignty, etc., but only if you're doing commerce. If that makes sense. So that's where I find it narrower than it should be. And that's where I see his sort of particular model of Europe kind of infringing on his judgment.
I mean, so what is he uses the term commerce, I mean commercium in his thought is broader than commerce. It's in fact plays a role in the critical philosophy, but yeah, I mean, I guess he uses it fairly narrowly there. Yeah, I mean, this is a hard issue because there is that part in Perpetual, there is that line in Perpetual Peace where he says that a state has a right to turn away anyone unless, what does he say? It says unless it will cause them mortal danger.
Immediate destruction or something.
I mean it seems at least there. I mean that some like Pauline Kleingeld has pointed to that as the basis of some refugee rights, and that might fit into the kind of Ben Habib view that he seems to suggest, at least at that point, that we're working with some kind of baseline conception of human rights, I guess you could say broadly. I mean, what do you make of that part of the text?
I think that's a very generous reading of what's going on. So again, if we go back to how he ends up here, he starts with the shape of the earth. So it's based on, he's going to say, oh, hospitality is based on the right of possession in common of everyone, right? So we all live here, so we have a right of possession everywhere. So that's the sort of semi or quasi a priori justification of hospitality. But then he's going to say, it's not a moral, so it's not out of moral reasons. It's not about philanthropy to be hospitable to others, right? It's not a moral dictum, be hospitable. It's a pragmatic or political dictum, be hospitable if someone is coming to you for commerce. That's it. So it's so limited that I am actually kind of shocked at how people take it to be so capacious in terms of, oh, it can include this and this and that. So
I mean, it should be juridical, right? Because it's Recht, but it's not clear.
Yeah.
You know, there's no world court to enforce the right.
Yeah. So exactly. So I think that's why it's kind of this. It's a weird one. I mean, you're right. If there was a world court, then it would be just, you know, if you are not acting hospitably, there's consequences, but there isn't.
Right.
You know, so it is not an ethical principle or a moral principle as he understands it. It's not one of philanthropy as he says explicitly. It is merely juridical, and it's even more limited to the possibility of commerce. But I guess what I'm interested in here, again, if I take a step back and see, like, look at what Kant is doing with this way of thinking about the world, is he is reading the world almost correctly. I mean, these are the places where he's very much aware of the cruelty of what he calls the Sugar Islands, you know, or the cruelty that happened in India under England. He's reading the world and he's saying minimally, very minimally, we need this understanding of hospitality.
Good. So let's conclude with your conclusion, which is which you talk about the benefits of Kantian teleology or Kant's conception of teleology for political philosophy. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could say a little bit about what you take to be the just a few things about the general significance as a kind of take home lesson here. I was particularly interested in the way you described Kant's teleology is provisional and revisable, and we've mentioned these already. But you say, you know, what's the broader significance here of Kant's teleology?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I guess the way that when we bring in teleology to our reading of Kant's political philosophy, we have a broader archive to work with, or broader sort of picture to work with. So we are not just working in variations of cosmopolitanism and should we have a world state, should we not have a world state, etc. So we are looking at Kant's political philosophy as a whole and seeing, look, he was also interested in understanding the world so that he can propose better solutions to the problems as he's reading them, right? So he's reading the problem of, oh, history seems so haphazard, let me provide some purpose to it and we'll go from there. You know, geography, political geography, the world is all over the place and there is nature doing all of these things to us. Can we harness these kinds of things for political purposes? So he's asking these kinds of questions about history, culture, etc. That gives us an advantage, I think, to broaden our perspective of politics a little bit and sort of be mindful of what we are presupposing when we are positing certain political ideals. Are we not just are they feasible? Are they achievable? Because ought implies can, let's say that's the case. But are they actually applying to all human beings, or are they provincial to the way that we read the world? So in a way, it encourages us to sort of clarify or make explicit our assumptions about how we read the world before we can work with ideals or ideal theory. So to me, if teleology is a way of thinking about the world, is a way of thinking about history, way of thinking about culture, even though, right, Kant's sample size was very small, he understood the world narrowly to be Europe. He understood culture to be narrowly European way of living. He understood geopolitics to be all about commerce. So his map of the world seems very small and very Eurocentric. But I think if teleology is not bound to one picture, that is his picture, I think we can go beyond that. And I think that is helpful for us to think about history, culture, and geography when we are thinking about political philosophy. That's the lesson I want to take from Kant, is not the way he thought about the world and human nature and history, but the way that when we read these texts, if we are not defensive about, like, oh, you know, he said Europe, but it's actually everyone, if we can actually acknowledge that, no, he actually just meant European white man, that gives us sort of his picture of the world. And so maybe we can see if our picture of the world is that or larger or bigger, and we can be more explicit with our commitments of how we are reading the world.
Right. Yeah, Kant gives us a kind of critical tool that you can use against Kant, right?
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Well, this great book and a great conversation, Dilek. Thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, thank you so much. This was great. This is a very close reading, and I hope that people now have a sense of the book. And if anyone has any questions, they can contact me.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.